In 2009, like today, the country faced economic peril. Back then, Congress passed a stimulus package that cut taxes, expanded unemployment support, and more. The 2009 Recovery Act cost around $800 billion. And the person put in charge of overseeing how a lot of that money was spent was the country's new vice president, Joe Biden. Now, as Biden seeks the presidency, his handling of that crisis could shape whether voters think he's up to the job of handling this one. NPR's Asma Khalid has more.
On the day Barack Obama signed the Recovery Act in February 2009, he explicitly thanked Joe Biden for working behind the scenes to make the legislation possible. When Biden took the mic, he acknowledged the economy was in a downward spiral.
Last year, our economy lost 3 million jobs, 600,000 more just this last month.
And he promised a recovery.
We're here today to start to turn that around.
President Obama signed the bill, but then he swiftly handed all the supervision over to his vice president. Here's Obama describing Biden's new role.
As part of his duty, Joe will keep an eye on how precious tax dollars are being spent. To you, he's Mr. Vice President, but around the White House, we call him the sheriff.
Former aides say Biden took it personally if any stimulus dollars were wasted. Ron Klain was his chief of staff at the time.
We put a real big emphasis on the Recovery Act in transparency and accountability.
Estimates show around 1% of the roughly $800 billion was ever attributed to waste or fraud. Klain says being accountable also meant being efficient.
He held meetings with the cabinet as a whole, the various agencies that are part of this, every other week to try to make sure we were moving quickly.
The vice president traveled the country to see stimulus projects in action, and every week he held phone calls with a rotating group of bipartisan governors and mayors.
The vice president insisted that the Recovery Implementation Office that reported to him, they had what he called the 24-hour rule, which is any question that a governor or a mayor raised got an answer within 24 hours.
Biden's real role was kind of opaque to people outside the White House. He occasionally gave press updates, but Jason Furman, who was the deputy director of the National Economic Council at the time, says that wasn't really what he did.
He wasn't even that much the public face of the Recovery Act. He was really almost behind the scenes, making sure it actually worked.
The impression from our end was that the vice president's role was something of a joke.
That last voice is Michael Steele, a former aide to John Boehner, who at the time was the Republican leader in the House.
Calling him Sheriff Joe and promising rigorous oversight of this program, it frankly symbolized that the president's priority, his attention, had shifted immediately to health care.
This was around the time that President Obama was starting to push for the Affordable Care Act. On the Recovery Act, Steele was peeved with the Obama administration as a whole. He says it did not court Republicans as much as it should have. Not a single Republican in the House signed on. Democrats insist they did try to court Republicans, and in fact won over a few in the Senate, thanks to Biden. But the lack of GOP support in the House had side effects. Doug Holtz-Eakin, a former economic advisor to John McCain's presidential campaign, says it made the Democrats more exposed to Republicans screaming about every dollar that didn't go right. And he says that affected how the Democrats implemented the stimulus.
So what do? They get more careful, which is at odds with recovery. You want to get the money out the door. It's an open question whether the vice president could have done something about that, but that's what he had to live with.
The question now is what this all means for the current moment. Jared Bernstein was Biden's chief economist during the Recovery Act.
He may be the most battle-tested president from the perspective of implementing stimulus plans than anyone I can think of.
Even Holtz-Eakin, who thinks the 2009 stimulus was flawed, did not take issue directly with Biden. In fact, as critical as he was of the Recovery Act itself, he told me Biden's experience could be advantageous in our current times.
I think it's an asset. He can now, in his head, think, okay, we've got $350 billion at the SBA, and we've got $500 over at Treasury. They're going to have this list of problems. And he knows that.
The election in November may very well be decided by how President Trump handles the current crisis and its aftermath. As his likely Democratic opponent, Biden's campaign fully intends to put his record up as an alternative. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Xfinity, with retail stores that showcase technology for your home, including home security and automation. More at Xfinity.com. And the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, bridging science and the arts by supporting The Gene, An Intimate History, a TV series about the genetic revolution in medical science, airing on PBS in April. More at sloan.org.
Coming up on WBUR's All Things Considered, we speak with the governor of Arkansas about why his state is among those still holding out and not asking people to stay at home. On Wall Street, the week starts with big gains. The Dow grew by 7.73%. That's 1,672 points. Closed at 22,680. S&P and NASDAQ rose more than 7%. The S&P finished at 2664. The NASDAQ ended the day at 7913. Marketplace has details at 6:30. It's 19 past 4.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by MIT Sloan Executive Education, with 55 short courses, executive certificates, and custom programs to revolutionize the way you do business. MIT Sloan Executive Education. And MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
A gorgeous day. Let's get the forecast for meteorologist Dave Epstein.
We'll see plenty of sunshine the rest of the afternoon. Low 60s inland, 50s at the coast. Tonight, partly cloudy down towards 40. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, 50s at the coast. Low 60s inland. On Wednesday, rain in the morning, clouds in the afternoon, approaching 50. Thursday, rain in the afternoon, cloudy in the morning, temperature near 50. Friday, partly sunny around 50.
In Boston, 61 degrees now. This is 90.9 WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFA Institute. CFA charterholders are wealth managers committed to helping unlock opportunities for their clients' ambitious wealth goals. Learn more at therightquestion.org. From Rock Auto, an online auto parts store, shipping parts directly to customers worldwide. Everything from complex sensors to new carpet. More at rockauto.com. And from the ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Wisconsin was all set to hold its statewide election tomorrow. It was the lone holdout after more than 20 other states postponed elections due to the coronavirus pandemic. But earlier today, Governor Tony Evers issued an executive order effectively moving Wisconsin's election to June. The state's Republican-controlled legislature opposes the move, and it's part of a growing political fight around voting during this health crisis. Joining us now is NPR's Miles Parks, who covers voting for us. Hi, Miles.
Hi there.
For weeks, it seemed like Wisconsin was going to go forward with tomorrow's election. Why the last-minute shift?
Well, first of all, health guidance has obviously continued to get more serious every day and over the last week or so. In his order, Governor Evers says there's no good answer to this problem, but that he has an obligation to keep people safe, and so he needed to delay the election. What's interesting, though, is that just a few days ago, his stance was that he did not have the authority to move the election without the legislature weighing in. But he's been under enormous pressure from voting advocacy groups and other Democrats. So today he issues this order. The Republican leaders in the legislature immediately announced that they were suing to challenge the delay, however. So we still really have no idea whether in-person voting is going to be taking place tomorrow or not.
What is the argument that Republicans in Wisconsin are making for holding the election with in-person voting right now?
So one argument is that Wisconsin is more complicated than other primary states that have delayed their primaries. They have local elections scheduled tomorrow as well. So the legislature didn't want to deal with a bunch of vacancies as a result of delaying Election Day. They also said simply it would be really confusing for voters to delay the election this close to when they're supposed to show up.
President Trump is one of those who did not want the election moved. He's been very vocal generally on the subject of changing voting rules to accommodate this crisis. What's his rationale?
Right. He's been pretty universally opposed to things that would make voting easier, make voting more accessible during this pandemic. On Fox News last week, he said that if the country implemented the voting reforms that Democrats want, specifically emergency nationwide vote by mail, that Republicans would never win another election. And then on Friday, Trump talked about fraud related to mail ballots and how he says it's harder to commit voter fraud if you have to actually go in person to the polling place.
It shouldn't be mail-in voting. It should be you go to a booth and you proudly display yourself.
Well, Miles, what does the research say? Is fraud any more prevalent with mail-in ballots?
There is slightly more fraud in the vote-by-mail space than in-person voting, which is to say it happens very, very infrequently instead of almost never. It's very rare in both instances. But it is worth noting that this is a change of opinion for Trump. For years, he's been saying, without evidence, that there was massive amounts of in-person fraud in the 2016 election, for instance. So it seems like his opinion on this in-person fraud issue has changed as the desire for mail voting has increased because of the pandemic.
So President Trump says Republicans would be at a disadvantage if the country voted by mail. Will you fact-check that for us? Is that claim true?
So there's obviously a lot of concern from Republicans about this right now, but the data is actually really mixed. It's definitely not as cut and dry as the president seems to think it is. I talked to Nate Persily, who's an elections expert at Stanford, about it.
If you think that the most vulnerable population to the coronavirus are older people, they tend to vote Republican disproportionately, and they might be the ones who would be most likely to vote by mail. And so it's not clear who wins as a result of moving to these kinds of measures.
In general, even unrelated to the virus, the voting populations that we normally think of as Republican, you know, older white populations, they've traditionally been a lot better at using vote by mail. Younger voters tend to be more transient. They change their addresses frequently, which makes it harder for them. But over the long term, it's clear that Trump and some other Republicans who've said similar things see the overall trend toward increasing turnout that vote by mail might bring as a danger to them politically.
That is NPR's Miles Parks. Thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
To London now, where we have this news tonight. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been moved to the intensive care unit of a London hospital. He's being treated there for COVID-19. After first trying to cope with the symptoms at home, Johnson was admitted to St. Thomas's Hospital on Sunday. And today, his condition worsened. He was moved to the critical care unit. Let me bring in NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. And Frank, what exactly are we being told about the Prime Minister's condition?
Not a lot, Mary Louise, just that he's been moved into the ICU in case he needs a ventilator. Downing Street says he is conscious, so they obviously felt that was something they needed to make clear. And we don't know a lot more. St. Thomas is a hospital just across Westminster Bridge, very close to number 10 Downing Street, across from Big Ben. It has been designated for handling COVID-19 patients. And so that is the logical place for him to be, with a lot of specialists in the ICU there.
Okay, so many questions. Starting with who is running the country with the Prime Minister in intensive care?
Well, Downing Street says that the Prime Minister has deputized Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab to handle some of the day-to-day business of government and the COVID-19 response. Naturally, this is supposed to be temporary while Johnson recovers in the hospital. Now, Raab chaired the COVID-19 meeting this morning for the government. And at a press conference this afternoon, Raab said he talked to Johnson back on Saturday and said that Johnson had been in good spirits. People were struck, given the importance of Raab and this whole governmental equation here, that he hadn't been in touch sooner, or more recently, rather. Raab is a Brexiteer, capable politician from Surrey, which is a county just outside of London.
Huh. I do want to ask about Boris Johnson's partner. I know that they are expecting a baby. Do we know how she's doing?
Her name is Carrie Symons, Boris Johnson's fiance. They are planning to marry, but I guess it'll be quite some time, given everything that's going on in the country right now. She did have COVID-19 symptoms, but she says that she's doing much better. And so that's good news. As you would remember, you know, COVID-19 has really ripped through the government here. Chris Whitty, he's the chief medical officer. He just appeared at a press conference today, having disappeared for a long time with COVID-19 systems. Matt Hancock, the secretary of health, he was gone for a week. So it's been knocking people down, and then fortunately they've been coming back.
Yeah. And with Boris Johnson himself, just how has this progressed? I was looking, he was tweeting earlier today that he was in good spirits. He was tweeting from the hospital.
Yeah.
He seemed to have only mild symptoms. You know, what happened?
Well, I think, Mary Louise, I think the public here has been a lot more concerned about this over the last 10 days. Naturally, they've seen this very gregarious populist kind of politician who loves to press the flesh, loves to get out there. 10 days ago, he said he had a persistent cough and a high fever. He disappeared from the press conferences, which was a bad sign. He no longer did live public speeches. He just put out a few cell videos. When he came out last Thursday at number 10 Downing Street to cheer on the nurses, he looked really sick. You could tell that he had, you know, heavy flu-like symptoms. And of course, what happened today, I think, has confirmed the worst fears of people in this country.
Yeah, and just in the few seconds we have left, Frank, just update us. Overall, where does the situation stand with COVID-19 in the UK?
The death number now is nearly 5,400 people. This is bad timing. The government does not have the testing capacity that it needs to really make a move forward. And at this press conference today, they were not really even willing to talk too much about the strategy they have for lifting the lockdown and moving forward.
Right. NPR's Frank Langfitt reporting there from London. Thank you, Frank.
You're very welcome, Mayor Louise.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. In the forecast, sunshine through the evening hours. A few clouds moving in overnight tonight, down around 40. Tomorrow should be much like today. Lots of sunshine in the low 60s. Cooler by the coast, though. Wednesday, clouds roll back in and stay a while. Should be rainy Wednesday morning. Dry later on, topping out at 50 degrees. And then for Thursday, rain should hold off until the afternoon, right about 50. Friday should bring back some sunshine. In the Boston area, 61 degrees now at 4:30.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the De Magistris family of Il Casale, the Wellington, and Restaurant Dante. Wishing you and your family well during these difficult times, and looking forward to welcoming you when they reopen. And Bowie Health. As the state has announced, Bowie is helping Massachusetts residents understand symptoms and find care in the time of coronavirus. At Bowie.com/mass.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. We'll have the latest news on COVID-19, but also the long history of presidents trying to comfort the nation during times of crisis. Historian Julian Zelizer will remind us words and actions count.
And we answer your questions about the coronavirus outbreak. That's next time on Here and Now.
Tomorrow at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is now in the intensive care unit at St. Thomas Hospital in London. His coronavirus case, including a persistent fever, not having abated since he first revealed it 11 days ago. Johnson's symptoms are now described as having worsened. Earlier today, he declared on Twitter he was in good spirits. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has been deputized to stand in for him. Another cruise ship carrying some sick passengers and crew is now docked in Miami. NPR's Greg Allen has the latest.
The Coral Princess arrived in Miami Saturday with more than 60 sick passengers and crew. Some tested positive for COVID-19. Healthy passengers are taking charter flights home. Most of the sick are remaining on the ship, where they'll be treated by the cruise line's medical staff. Eight of the passengers, though, were taken to Florida hospitals. One man who waited hours for an ambulance Saturday died after arriving at the hospital. Two other passengers died while the ship was en route. The Coral Princess arrived in Miami just 2 days after another cruise ship with sick passengers docked in Fort Lauderdale and sent several of the sickest to area hospitals. Officials in South Florida say hospitals here still have excess capacity, including ICU beds and ventilators, but there were where they soon may not have enough to accommodate sick people from cruise ships. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
South Korea has been making strong gains against COVID-19, but as NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports, there's concern about a loosening of social distancing practices.
They were trying to transition to what they call sustainable social distancing. In other words, sort of easing up on the social distancing to find a way to get along, to basically do their work and have their lives, but settle in with the virus for the long term. And they had to shelve those because they said they're just not there yet.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn reporting on Wall Street. A big day. The Dow ended the day up 1627 at 22,679. This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Massachusetts health authorities are reporting 29 more deaths from the coronavirus. That brings the total statewide to 260. The number of deaths has more than doubled since last Wednesday. Nearly 14,000 people so far have tested positive. The state is expecting a surge in cases to begin later on this week. Meanwhile, a dramatic surge has already begun among the homeless population in Boston. New data show the rate of new cases among people who are homeless in the city is 7 times higher than it is in the state's general population. Dr. Jessie Gaeta with Boston Healthcare for the Homeless says her staff is stretched thin, so she's asking for help from available medical workers to contain the spread.
We got to do the best we can to flatten what is right now a very steep upward curve among homeless people in Boston. We can't do it alone. People that do community medicine, if you're not busy right now, we need you.
Gaeta says Boston Healthcare for the Homeless has tested between 600 and 700 people for the virus so far. About a third of them have tested positive. The intensive care unit at Boston Medical Center was treating so many patients yesterday that the hospital had to stop accepting new patients in the ICU. WBUR's Carrie Goldberg reports on what may be a first in Boston since the coronavirus pandemic began.
The hospital says overnight Sunday, ambulances brought patients to other hospitals instead. But today, Boston Medical Center is back to accepting ICU patients. Boston health officials say this is the first known case of a Boston hospital reaching ICU capacity during the current COVID-19 crisis. According to the most recent numbers from the Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association, Boston Medical Center has 140 COVID-19 patients, with 39 in the ICU. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
The average price of regular gasoline in the state is now less than $2 a gallon. AAA Northeast says the price dropped 6 cents from last week and landed at $1.99. At this time last year, gas was 56 cents higher. It's 4:35.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years. GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO.
Should have some clouds around tonight, not too many. Lows around 40. Then for tomorrow, sunny again in the low 60s. Wednesday should bring rain in the early hours and clouds later on, right about 50 degrees. Thursday, clouds and showers sticking to about 50. 61 degrees now in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from TIAA, committed to the idea that while most things in life run out, from clean shirts in the morning to a favorite dessert at night, lifetime income in retirement shouldn't. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout. And from C3.AI. C3.AI's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.AI.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Surgeon General Jerome Adams says this week is going to be tough.
The next week is going to be our Pearl Harbor moment. It's going to be our 9/11 moment. It's going to be the hardest moment for many Americans in their entire lives.
Most governors have issued broad statewide stay-at-home orders to slow the spread of the coronavirus. 9 have not. Dr. Anthony Fauci from the White House Coronavirus Task Force says he wishes they would.
If you look at what's going on in this country, I just don't understand why we're not doing that. We really should be.
Well, among the states that have not issued a broad stay-at-home order, Arkansas, and Arkansas Governor Republican Asa Hutchinson joins us now. Governor, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you today.
So I know you have closed bars and restaurant dining rooms in Arkansas. I know today you closed schools through the end of the school year. Why not issue a formal stay-at-home order?
Well, we've done much more than that. Ours is a targeted response that has proven to be effective. If you look at any of the measuring sticks, we have reduced the spread. Our growth rate is lower than it is in most of the other states, some with even a stringent stay-at-home order. And one of the things that we've done is not just have enforced social distancing, but also wearing masks. That's what is needed as to slowing the spread, and we've been somewhat successful in that. And as a result of that, our case number has reduced its growth. You know, our hospitalizations is 74 in Arkansas, and so we're, I think Dr. Fauci and everyone would be very pleased with actually where we are right now. And we're going to continue to look at it. If we have to do more, we will. But the stay-at-home order is a little bit misleading because, you know, if we put in a stay-at-home order today, then tomorrow morning, 700,000 Arkansans would go to work. And people would say, what's the difference? Because if you don't have the social distancing or wear a mask, then you're going to continue to spread. So we're doing a targeted approach that emphasizes those points, and we make adjustments as needed.
And I appreciate your laying all that out for us. Thank you. Let me follow up on a couple things you said. One, in terms of the number of cases. I'm looking at numbers that show confirmed cases in Arkansas rose more than 80% in the last week, 854 today versus 473 last Monday, which I suppose prompts a question of, you know, how do you know how well your state is doing when testing has been so problematic everywhere, nationwide?
Because they measure testing in every state, and every state has struggled with the same things that we struggle with. But we've had over 11,000 tests in Arkansas, and our testing is very similar to what it is in other states.
But are those numbers correct, that confirmed cases in Arkansas are up more than 80% in the last week?
Well, if you look at the you know, the measuring stick of how fast does it take to double the number of our cases, we have slowed that down. So now that it takes 7 days is our most recent doubling, which is really slowing and flattening that curve. If you look at the report that I received from Dr. Birch today, you know, Arkansas is very flat in terms of its growth rate. And so I think we're where we should be. If we need to do more, we will.
Another point you mentioned jobs, which is, of course, on your mind as governor. What would you say to those who would accuse you of prioritizing the economy over the health of people in your state?
Well, I would disagree with that. I listen to my health professionals, Dr. Smith and his team of the Department of Health, and if they say we need to do more, we'll do more. That's important that we make decisions based upon public health.
But you heard Dr. Fauci. I mean, you're hearing the most senior infectious disease specialist in the country saying, I wish everybody would have a stay-at-home order in place.
Well, also the Surgeon General yesterday had an opportunity in his message, and he didn't disagree with what we're doing. He just wants us to concentrate as much as we can this week, and we're doing that. And so we're following the CDC guidelines. We're doing what makes a difference in Arkansas, and we're having success at it. And if we have to do more, we will absolutely do more because public health is essential. But we don't want to put people out of work unless there's a good public health benefit to do that.
It sounds like you don't rule out something down the road. Just one quick question in the seconds we have left. How do you weigh responsibility to your neighbors, to say Tennessee, Louisiana? I interviewed your counterpart, John Bell Edwards of Louisiana, just on Friday. He told me he's extremely worried. He's got a stay-at-home order through April 30th.
Well, I talked to John Bell Edwards today, and we sent him 5 ventilators from Arkansas to help them through their very tough time.
Is that right?
We're working in a partnership, and we'll continue to do that.
That is Governor Asa Hutchinson. Always good to have you on the program. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Mexico's president says his government won't be bailing out banks or giving tax breaks to big businesses hurt by the coronavirus. Instead, he's promising to help the poor. NPR's Kerry Kahn went out on the streets and found the need is urgent.
Every morning around 7 a.m., Mario Alberto Martinez and his wife, Ariana Castro, set up their tiny food stand on a small median strip.
¿Me das una tortita de verde? ¿Qué cuesta el sandwich?
At this usually busy intersection in a tree-lined neighborhood near downtown Mexico City, the couple sells breakfast on the go, small sandwiches, sweetbreads, and hot coffee. Sales are plummeting.
No sé, como 10 personas yo creo, por mucho.
Castro says at the most this morning they've had about 10 customers. Usually they sell to more than 50 or 60.
Y no tanto para nosotros, sino para todos los puestos. Pero te digo, acá había uno.
Martinez says it's not just their stand suffering. He points across the street and says over there was a woman who sold quesadillas. She hasn't showed up for days. And he adds neither has the guy who sells newspapers and shines shoes on the corner.
No, si no ganamos, no comemos.
If we don't work, we don't eat, he says. He's not afraid of contracting the virus. He's more worried about dying of hunger.
Estamos en alerta sanitaria, por lo que se invita a la ciudadanía a retirarse de las calles y mantenerse dentro de sus domicilios para...
Police cars patrol the neighborhood playing this message, ordering residents off the streets. On April 1st, the government ordered all non-essential businesses closed. While most have shut their doors, some street vendors managed to keep selling.
Dame cuatro, por favor. ¿Puede ser campechano?
This neighborhood favorite selling fried chicken sandwiches is still operating on a corner with a line of customers, very few with masks on and even fewer practicing safe distancing. Street vendors are just trying to survive, says Diana Sanchez Barrios, who leads an organization representing the sellers. It's going to get more difficult in Mexico City, where she says 1.3 million people sell on the streets and won't be able to stay in their homes for long. Many will have to go out and search for some way to make money. Ariana Castro, who sells breakfast fare in the intersection median, says that's what she'll have to do.
Quizá podremos parar una semana, por mucho dos, pero ya más es imposible.
Maybe we can stay off the streets 1 or at the most 2 weeks, she says. But more than that will be impossible. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Mexico City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The acting Secretary of the Navy had some disparaging words for Captain Brett Crozier, the ousted commander of the USS Theodore Roosevelt. The Navy Secretary spoke to the ship's crew while aboard the carrier. The former commander of the Roosevelt was reassigned after he wrote a memo complaining about the Navy's reaction to the coronavirus outbreak aboard the carrier. The memo leaked, the crisis went public, and Navy officials have been working to contain it ever since. NPR has now obtained a copy of the leaked audio of the acting Navy Secretary addressing the crew, and NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman joins us to discuss it. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Ari.
So what did the acting Secretary Thomas Modley say in this leaked audio?
Well, he was pretty defensive, Ari, and he told the crew that he and Navy leaders were working to help Captain Crozier deal with the virus before that letter was written. Let's listen.
I want you to know that no one at my level has been ignoring the situation here from the very beginning. I reached out to your CO through my chief of staff very, very early on in this crisis.
And Modley has previously said that they were already rushing medical personnel to the ship, planning to remove sailors, but probably not as fast as Captain Crozier wanted. And Modley went on in his talk to the crew to sharply criticize the captain for sending that letter to more than 20 people. Here he is again.
He didn't think that information was going to get out into the public in this information age that we live in, that he was, A, too naive or too stupid to be the commanding officer of a ship like this. The alternate is that he did it on purpose, and that's a serious violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Now, the letter was first published by the San Francisco Chronicle, Crozier's hometown paper. Modley mentioned that fact at a Pentagon briefing last week, but acknowledged he has no information Crozier leaked it to the paper. Now, Modley's office in a statement today said the secretary has not heard this audio, but neither he nor anyone in the Navy is disputing the authenticity of the tape. Modley said in a statement he spoke from the heart to the crew, and he stands by every word.
And can you tell how the crew received those remarks?
You know, we don't know. There seemed to be a silence when the secretary concluded. We do know Crozier was popular with the crew. He got a rousing send-off from his crew when he left the carrier with shouts of Captain Crozier, Captain Crozier. Colleagues have rushed to defend the captain, calling him a fine officer. Crozier is a Naval Academy grad. He flew both helicopters as well as the F-18 warplane. Modley criticized him as being too emotional during a Pentagon briefing, again last week, indicating the captain just couldn't handle the stress of the virus. Now, reportedly, Pentagon and Navy officers did not want Crozier relieved from command. They preferred to have an investigation and go forward from there. Secretary Moodley, who is also, by the way, a Naval Academy grad and flew helicopters himself, said he wanted to remove Crozier and no one stood in his way. A number of people I've been talking with at the Pentagon here, Ari, they're just shaking their heads over how this was handled, saying it was a disaster.
Just in our final seconds, how is the health of the crew and what's the status of the outbreak?
Well, the ship is still on Guam, and they've tested 61% of the roughly 5,000 sailor crew. 173 sailors so far have tested positive. No one is hospitalized. Many are staying ashore, some in hotels. Now, Crozier himself reportedly tested positive, according to those who know him. But the captain, according to the Navy, doesn't want to comment on that.
NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman, thank you for the update.
You're welcome, Ari.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Stanhope Framers, Back Bay and Union Square, Somerville. Over 40 years in the art of fine picture framing, museum-grade custom frames made in their workshop, stanhopeframers.com. And Commonwealth Psychology, offering online telehealth talk therapy, counseling, and psychiatry services for kids and adults. Compsych.com.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Look for sunshine remaining for the next couple of hours. Then some clouds moving in overnight tonight, down around 40 degrees overnight. Tomorrow should be a lot like today. Lots of sunshine in the low 60s, cooler by the coast and on the Cape and Islands. Wednesday clouds roll back in and stay a while. Should be rainy Wednesday morning, dry later on, topping out at 50. Then for Thursday, rain should hold off until the afternoon, right about 50. Friday should bring back some sunshine. 61 degrees now at 449.
WBUR supporters include BU College of Fine Arts, graduate degree programs on campus and online in music, theater, and visual arts. More at bu.edu/CFA.
On a reservation in Wyoming, some Native American families are crowded into two-bedroom houses.
Me and my husband, we have 8 children.
Putting them at extra risk of spreading COVID-19.
If one individual tests positive for it, of course it's going to be hard to quarantine just that one child and not us as parents.
The challenges of a pandemic when housing is in short supply. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9. And when you ask your smart speaker to play WBUR.
This is WBUR's All Things Considered. I'm Lisa Mullins. Boston's homeless community is experiencing a significant increase in coronavirus cases. About 200 people who are homeless have tested positive for the virus, according to Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program. 600 to 700 have been tested at tents set up outside the biggest shelters in the city. There are no known deaths from COVID-19 among people who are homeless in Boston, but some are hospitalized in intensive care on ventilators. There is a growing sense of urgency among clinicians and homeless service providers. Dr. Jesse Gaeta, the chief medical officer for Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, says there's also increased anxiety among people who are homeless because of the virus and because of having to move to different facilities for quarantine and isolation. Dr. Gaeta says it's already been a difficult week.
We're in about day 3 of a significant surge that is more dramatic than we anticipated. We've got many new cases per day now that we're discovering, and we're working desperately to take those folks out of congregate settings into places where they can be isolated.
And is there some commonality among the people who are testing positive right now? Are they in a particular area? Do they have a roof over their heads right now?
We have, together with help from the city and others, we have stood up now a handful of isolation facilities, including 2 tents here in the South End, including what was the old Kindred Hospital on Commonwealth Avenue, where we've got space for about 70 people. And now, because the need is outpacing our ability to put people in those facilities, we're working really hard right now to scale up much bigger isolation facilities. So those things are evolving rapidly. We're going to need those beds now. The kind of overall strategy right now is test as many people as we can in congregate settings and pull out everyone who tests positive into isolation.
And how many of those people have been brought to the hospital?
We're actually trying only to bring to the hospital the people who are moderately to severely ill. What I can tell you is that most of the people testing positive right now don't have symptoms, which is exactly what we've come to expect from what we've learned about this virus, is that it can be transmitted before people have symptoms.
And are you able to get sufficient testing kits and get a fast turnaround on the results?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's improved quite a bit. So the turnaround on the test results right now, as we've been mostly using the state lab, has been much quicker. It's down to about 24 hours. You know, the testing resources, though, are kind of seem to be waxing and waning a little. So whereas we were able to test over the course of last Thursday and Friday, we were able to test about 400 people in 2 days. Today, we don't have enough testing kits to keep going at that clip, and the state is trying hard to help with that resource.
Can you give us a picture? Is there kind of a line of people right now waiting mm-hmm, to be mm-hmm. tested, and are you able to have them maintain the proper distance from each other? I mean, what's it like there?
Yeah, it's really hard. So, you know, when people are coming into the front door of a shelter, there can be bunches of people, and we try really hard to ask people to keep distance, and it's hard for everyone. I was just thinking about the fact that we tested about 400 people last Thursday and Friday in shelter, and to do that, we set up 3 testing tents, and we got really efficient with the paperwork and the procedure itself. And it was raining on Thursday and Friday. Like, it was actually terrible outside. And so these folks were lined up. In some cases, it was, you know, many people lined up and trying to space out. So the line looked like it was a couple blocks long.
This is a difficult population because many of these people have underlying health conditions. But could you tell us, is there a profile you can give us of the kind of people you're seeing who are testing positive? Or is it hitting the general population pretty much across the board?
It's hitting the general population across the board. I guess what I would say is what's unique about this population is just by virtue of not having a home, they're likely to be living in congregate, very crowded settings. And so they're at higher risk of transmission just by virtue of that fact. So we're seeing right now that the rate of new cases in among homeless people per 1,000 people is about 7 times what it is across the state of Massachusetts. And so we're on a steeper incline right now for homeless people in Boston than we are generally, and that makes sense. We're changing the way that we work dramatically right now because we have large populations of people who are positive and have a lot of risk of deterioration, you know, and we're working with fewer staff than we'd like, and we're doing the best we can. It feels like disaster medicine.
And when you say working with fewer staff, is that because you're generally understaffed anyway or for this particular circumstance?
No, we're generally so well staffed, but we've pretty much have had to really pivot on a dime from our usual activities of providing primary care in shelters and in clinics set up specifically for this population. We've had to nearly abandon all of that work, a lot of it, and pivot to this public health work, which is identifying people who are positive and scooping them out of the general population as soon as we can. We're stretched thin. You know, many of us on staff here at Healthcare for the Homeless you know, attend on the inpatient wards at MGH or BMC, and they're pulling their staff in to handle the crisis of severely ill patients in the hospital. And we're staying where we are in the community, but fewer and fewer nurses and doctors are able to provide community care because the hospitals need so many people.
Let me ask you that about that, though. Do you feel like you're being shortchanged?
No, I don't feel like we're shortchanged. I think we need our healthcare resources where the people are the sickest. Like, you've got to triage us the way we would triage or prioritize anything else. I think we're definitely going to need help, and we're going to need more people.
So you're kind of putting out the call right now, recruiting people.
I'm definitely putting out the call for action. This is what we've trained our whole lives for. This is our moonshot. We've got to do the best we can to flatten what is right now a very steep upward curve among homeless people in Boston. We can't do it alone. I do think we need our intensivists and hospitalists working in the hospital, people that do community medicine. If you're not busy right now, we need you.
We wish you luck. Dr. Jesse Gaeta, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Jesse Gaeta of Boston's Healthcare for the Homeless program.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com. From Drexel University, recognizing 100 years of a cooperative education program that prepares students to address the challenges of a changing world. More at drexel.edu/ambitioncantwait. From Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
Got a couple more hours of sunshine on the way, then partly cloudy skies moving in tonight, lows about 40. Tomorrow, sunny again in the low 60s once again. Then Wednesday should bring in rain in the early hours, clouds later on, right about 50. Thursday, clouds and showers again, sticking to about 50 degrees. 61 degrees still in the Boston area at 1 before 5.
WBUR supporters include Krakow-Witkin Gallery, where you can explore an eclectic collection of works from more than 60 artists. Works on view at KrakowWitkinGallery.com.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster.
Streaming at WBUR.org.
And when you ask your smart speaker to play WBUR,
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
The coronavirus continues to rage in parts of the U.S., especially in New York City.
It's very hard to see the number of deaths we're having. It's frightening and it's disturbing, that amount of loss.
Today is Monday, April 6th, and this is WBUR's All Things Considered. That story coming up. I'm Lisa Mullins. Also ahead in Chicago, black residents make up 29% of the population, but they represent 70% of the city's COVID-19 deaths. A smaller program in New York connects people who want to donate a bicycle with essential workers who need one to get around.
There are thousands of cyclists in New York who may have an extra bike that could be in the hands now of a frontline worker.
Matchmaking bikes coming up. Also, the U.S. Supreme Court issues a ruling that makes it easier for federal workers to prove allegations of age discrimination. It's 1 past 5. News headlines are next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who has COVID-19, has been moved to an intensive care unit at a London hospital. NPR's Frank Langford has more from London.
Number 10 Downing Street said Johnson, 55, has been placed in an ICU to be close to a ventilator. The government emphasized that the prime minister remains conscious. Johnson was diagnosed with COVID-19 late last month, but has continued to run a fever and has had a persistent cough. The government said he was admitted to the hospital Sunday night as a precautionary measure and to have some tests performed. Downing Street says Johnson has deputized Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab to handle some of the day-to-day government business while the prime minister recovers. Raab led the latest government meeting and daily press conference on COVID-19. Frank Langford, NPR News, London.
For a second day in a row, coronavirus deaths in New York State are basically flat. Health officials say the state is at or very near the peak of fatalities there. For member station WSHU, Charles Lane reports Governor Andrew Cuomo, meanwhile, is cautiously optimistic, but continues to issue dire warnings.
Health officials cut in half their projection for how many beds will be needed in New York. They say the curve is flattening. But Governor Cuomo says it's unclear how long the deaths will continue. He says they have enough ventilators for now, but that hospitals are at capacity.
The engine is at red line, and you can't go any faster. And by the way, you can't stay at red line for any period of time.
Cuomo says other countries have made the mistake of thinking the virus was gone and relaxing social distancing guidelines, only to face a second wave of deaths. Cuomo has doubled the fine for gathering in groups to $1,000. For NPR News, I'm Charles Lane in New York.
Even as major metropolitan areas have continued to see high death rates as the coronavirus spreads, so far Washington, D.C. has had COVID-19 deaths only totaling in the dozens. However, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser says that could change, especially if people in the city back off social distancing guidelines aimed at slowing the spread of the virus.
We are concerned that the next wave, if you will, if you consider New York City the first wave, in other cities that we've heard about, that D.C. could be in the second wave.
In D.C., more than 1,000 people have tested positive for the virus. A stay-at-home order is in effect for the city's 700,000 residents. Coronavirus patients are globally volunteering to join studies of an experimental drug that showed promise against some viruses in the past. The drug remdesivir has been great enough in interest that U.S. Institutes of Health is announcing it intends to boost the size of a study. Drug maker Gilead Sciences is also enrolling its own patients in studies worldwide. Stocks gained ground today. The Dow was up 1,627 points. The Nasdaq rose 540 points. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Massachusetts authorities say seven more veterans have died since the end of last week at the state-run Soldiers Home in Holyoke, where there's an outbreak of the coronavirus. 25 residents are dead. 18 of them have tested positive for the virus. Another 59 veteran residents and 31 staff have also tested positive. The state has appointed an outside attorney to investigate the outbreak. The National Guard is overseeing testing of residents and staff. Members of Massachusetts' congressional delegation want to know why the federal government has not delivered hundreds of ventilators promised to the state. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman has more.
Governor Baker had negotiated with federal officials a week ago and expected 1,000 of the life-saving breathing devices to be delivered by this week. But yesterday, only 100 had arrived from the Strategic National Stockpile. Now the governor says he expects the shipment in 2 weeks. But in a letter to federal officials, members of the state's congressional delegation say, quote, given the growing need in Massachusetts, approving and sending only 100 ventilators to Massachusetts is absurd, and FEMA can and must do more to help Massachusetts during this crisis. Senator Elizabeth Warren questions why the Fed seized several of the state's recent orders for personal protective equipment. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Bruce Gellerman.
Meanwhile, a group of labor unions is calling on the state to better coordinate the production and distribution of personal protective equipment for medical professionals and laborers. In a letter to the unions, they say they want state leaders to better outline steps that local laboratories and businesses can take to speed up production. That letter comes as one of the state's largest construction unions walked off the job today to protest what it calls unsafe working conditions. The city of Boston's giving property owners an extension to pay real estate taxes. Mayor Marty Walsh is extending the property tax deadline by a month to give homeowners more flexibility during the pandemic. The new deadline is June 1st. In the forecast, bright skies today, partly cloudy tonight, down around 40. Tomorrow, mainly sunny and mild. Wednesday, showers early, gray all day, right about 50. Then for Thursday, clouds early, showers later on, again around 50 degrees. 61 degrees in the Boston area at 6 past 5.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by CBS All Access, presenting the new season of The Good Fight, with mystery, intrigue, and Memo 618. Christine Baranski returns in The Good Fight this Thursday on CBS All Access.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro at NPR headquarters in Washington.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly at my home studio. In New York today, Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo shared this news. For the second day in a row, his state did not see a large rise in COVID-19 deaths.
Total number of hospitalizations are down. The ICU admissions are down, and the daily intubations are down. Those are all good signs.
All good signs, yes, though not exactly good news when the state still has thousands of new cases confirmed every day. And it is unclear whether this marks the disease's peak in New York or not.
Nationwide, the death count has now passed 10,000. Detroit and Louisiana in particular have significant outbreaks right now. And White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx warns those hotspots may not see their peaks for another week. Here to catch us up on the latest are NPR science correspondent Richard Harris and White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Good to have you both back here.
Good to be here.
Hi, Ari.
Aisha, let's start with you. It seems like the administration is pushing two different ideas right now. First, here's the president on Sunday saying he sees the light at the end of the tunnel.
Things are happening. Things are happening. We're starting to see light at the end of the tunnel. And hopefully in the not-too-distant future, we'll be very proud of the job we all did.
And on that same day, the Surgeon General, Jerome Adams, says this to NBC's Meet the Press.
The next week is going to be our Pearl Harbor moment. It's going to be our 9/11 moment. It's going to be the hardest moment for many Americans in their entire lives. And we really need to understand that if we want to flatten that curve and get through to the other side, everyone needs to do their part.
Such a contrast there. Aisha, how does the administration reconcile these two messages?
It seems to be a matter of emphasis The White House task force is saying that they think the peak of the outbreak is going to hit in the next 6 to 7 days in New York City, Detroit, and Louisiana. And it seems like the Surgeon General and others want to prepare the public for how bad it's going to get. So public health officials are urging people to stay away from others, wash your hands, all the measures to prevent infection at this critical point. But the Surgeon General and the president are also saying that there will be an end to this, that the country will come out on the other side of this. And that's the message that Trump at times seems to want to focus on the most. He has said many times that he sees himself as the country's cheerleader and he wants to give people hope. So his message has been more about seeing an end to this and what comes next. And at times, that has been premature.
Okay, so that's the messaging. Let's talk about the scientific models. Richard, what do the forecasts tell us about the epidemic trends right now? How likely is this to peak this week or next?
Well, the main model that is tracking this is from the University of Washington, and they just updated it. And it still finds that it varies. The results really vary state by state. New York still seems to be heading toward its peak this week. In fact, the number of new cases has been flattening out over the past few days. Whether that's a peak or a plateau is to be determined. And remember, more and more cases still stress the medical system. Mm-hmm. The model forecasts that the day where most hospital resources are needed is going to be around April 15th. And that overall trend, however, is based on people staying home through the end of May, not April, but May. Mm. If people go out sooner than that, the modelers project that it might only take a couple of weeks for the epidemic essentially to reignite.
Hmm. But there is some evidence, I take it, that social distancing is actually having the intended effect, that it's working?
Yes, indeed, that is the case, not only from Wuhan in China, but increasingly from other places like regions of Italy, where the curve is really bending downward. Here in the United States, we're really starting to see that in Washington State. Christopher Murray, who heads up the University of Washington model, said that mobile phone data shows that personal mobility, which is sort of a way of measuring social distancing, has been down for longer even than the state has had a stay-at-home directive. That's partly because big companies like Amazon and Microsoft acted very fast with their employees, telling them to work from home, and then lots of other companies followed suit. The model now shows Washington's curve has flattened out. In fact, it may already be past its peak, which actually, when you look at the chart, looks more like a hill than an alp.
Hmm. Interesting. I'd like to talk about the question of medical equipment. And Aisha, the president spent a lot of time over the weekend describing what he's doing to try to get supplies to states.
Areas in the country that are not experiencing large-scale infections are requesting supplies beyond what their present circumstances require. And we talk to them and we tell them and we explain it. And for the most part, they're good with it. we think we're right.
Governors and hospitals say this is their top issue. Why is President Trump pushing back?
Well, there are not enough of these critical supplies and equipment to fill all the requests. So Trump is arguing that officials are asking for more than they truly need. They're asking for things just to be on the safe side. And he's saying that while that's understandable, the federal government is prioritizing certain areas. That said, some governors obviously disagree with that and say the federal government is not stepping up the way it should for a national emergency. There are some states that are giving equipment back, Washington State, California, for example, so that FEMA can now send the equipment to where it's needed right now. Today, we may hear more about that hospital ship, the USNS Comfort in New York City. It was originally designated for people who don't have the virus, but there are so few people able to use it that they are considering switching it over for patients who do have the virus.
Interesting. And a bit more good news. I understand, Richard, that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have published a new study today about the coronavirus in children. What did it find?
Yes, it is good news. It finds that children here, as was the case in China, the kids are really less vulnerable to the coronavirus than adults. And when they looked at the survey of the data they had accumulated to date, only about 2% of the cases are in people under the age of 18, even though that age group makes up 22% of the population. So you can see they're really quite underrepresented, which is good in the hospital. The kids are unlikely to end up in the ICU or to lose their lives, very unlikely, as a matter of fact. The CDC identified just 3 deaths. And those who ended up in the ICU tend to have underlying health conditions or are infants under the age of 1. Now, the wrinkle here is that many kids don't have the classic symptoms. Only about half, for example, run a fever. So that means they may be spreading the disease without anyone noticing that they're infected. So that's a little wrinkle in the good news there. But it's also all the more reason to keep schools closed and to maintain social distancing. Unfortunately, that also means having no play dates.
And I suppose it also speaks to the importance of widespread testing.
Absolutely. And I think that that's still a bugaboo here. They keep talking about the fact that they were closing the gap in making testing available in a widespread basis, and the backlogs are diminishing. But that still is really a very important tool for combating this epidemic, and it's still not fully functional.
That is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris and NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Now, sure. COVID-19 is hitting Black Chicagoans hard. Of course, baseline health disparities play a role, and many African Americans in Chicago are considered essential workers, holding down jobs, driving buses, or working in grocery stores. As the pandemic continues to bring health and economic hardship, there are calls for attention to underlying racial inequities. From member station WBEZ in Chicago, Natalie Moore reports.
While Black residents make up about 29% of Chicago's population, a whopping 72% of the people who've died from COVID-19 in Chicago so far are Black. That's according to cases analyzed from Cook County Medical Examiner records. Linda Ray Murray is a retired doctor who teaches at the University of Illinois at Chicago School of Public Health. She says this high mortality rate for Blacks doesn't surprise her.
It makes me furious. It makes me angry. For African Americans, we have higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of high blood pressure, higher rates of coronary diseases, and many other medical conditions that make people more vulnerable to having bad outcomes with this virus.
The first person in Illinois to die of COVID-19 last month was a Black woman named Patricia Friason. A week later, her sister, Wanda Bailey, died. Both had underlying health conditions. Again, while 29% of Chicagoans are Black, the city's health commissioner says they account for 52% of those testing positive so far. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot says the numbers take her breath away.
This is a call to action moment for all of us. When we talk about equity and inclusion, they're not just nice notions. They are an imperative that we must embrace as a city. It's unacceptable. No one should think that this is okay.
Mayor Lightfoot announced a racial equity rapid response team. The idea is to work with community leaders to create a system of checking in on people and monitor what's happening, and then direct resources to vulnerable communities. While stay-at-home orders may be effective for people who can telework, local and national data show more of those employees are white, higher-wage workers. According to census data in Chicago, Blacks and Latinos are more likely to be essential workers holding down jobs like cooks and janitors. In addition, minority communities don't have equal access to health care, and the pandemic death toll underscores just how crucial health insurance is. Lightfoot says social distancing can be hard in communities where people must take the bus or live closer together. And she says the urgency of this crisis brings all these issues to light.
They are literally matters of life and death.
Helene Gale agrees. She has the Chicago Community Trust, which is co-managing a COVID relief fund. She's a former CEO of an international humanitarian group that helps communities recover from disasters like earthquakes and famine.
We used to talk about building back better, and that when communities were impacted, whether it was by natural or human emergencies, can we use the work that we're doing in emergency response to actually build a bridge to longer term so that we are building greater resiliency?
Gale says it would be impossible to learn from this pandemic without considering the role racial disparity is playing. For NPR News, I'm Natalie Moore in Chicago.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the businesses and organizations whose financial support allows WBUR to double down on the reporting our community relies on in these difficult times. We thank you and appreciate that we can count on you today and tomorrow.
This is WBUR. The week has started with big gains on Wall Street. The Dow grew by 7.73%. That's 1,627 points. It closed at 22,680. S&P and NASDAQ rose more than 7% each. The S&P finished the day at 2664. The NASDAQ ended the day at 7913. Marketplace has details at 6:30. It's 19 past 5.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by ThoughtForms, custom builders of new homes, renovations, and environmentally sensitive projects, supporting the MIT Sustainability Summit, focusing on leveraging food for a sustainable future, April 24th. Learn more at sustainablesummit.mit.edu and thoughtforms-corp.com.
The forecast now with meteorologist Dave Epstein.
We'll see partly to mostly sunny skies this evening, temperatures falling into the 50s. Late at night, we're down towards 40. On Tuesday, mostly sunny, low 60s, but 50s right at the coast. On Wednesday, rain in the morning, clouds in the afternoon near 50. Thursday, clouds in the morning, rain in the afternoon, temperature near 50. Partly sunny on Friday, also near 50.
It is 61 degrees now in the Boston area. Go to WBUR.org/coronavirus for the latest. If you'd like to post questions, find answers to questions. You can also check out the map that shows the number of coronavirus cases and deaths county by county in Massachusetts. That's WBUR.org/coronavirus.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's supports NPR's mission to create a more informed public. From Fidelity Wealth Management, where advisors work with their clients to develop flexible investment strategies that can evolve as their needs change. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The U.S. Supreme Court sided with older federal workers today, making it easier for those over 40 to sue for age discrimination. The 8-1 decision rejected a Trump administration position that sought to dramatically limit the legal recourse available to federal workers. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
The case was brought by Norris Babb, a clinical pharmacist who's worked for the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Bay Pines, Florida, for 16 years. During that time, she's qualified to practice disease management, see patients, and prescribe medication without consulting a physician. And she's gotten consistently high marks for her performance. But Babb says that beginning about 10 years ago, when she was in her late 40s, she and other women over the age of 45 found they were not getting newly classified advanced positions that paid more money. Instead, the women alleged those jobs went to people in their 30s, most of them men. When several of the women filed age discrimination and sex discrimination complaints, Babb supported those claims, and she contends that, as a result, the VA subjected her to systematic age discrimination, denying her eligibility for promotions, for training opportunities, and, she alleged, that supervisors made a variety of age-related comments. A federal district court judge initially threw out her case, declaring that Babb had failed to prove that her age was the only reason for these personnel actions. The Trump administration supported that ruling and, in doing so, overrode the position of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which long has said that if a federal worker can show that age was a factor in denying her a job or a promotion, the worker is entitled to appropriate remedies. But today, the Supreme Court said the Trump administration had been wrong and that the federal law clearly gives federal workers protection from any discrimination based on age. The court said Congress had very deliberately given federal workers more protection than workers in the private sector or those who work for state and local governments. Writing for the court majority, Justice Samuel Alito said that federal law demands that federal personnel action be untainted by any consideration of age. So if age was a factor here, as alleged, the process was not free from discrimination. Babb is entitled to appropriate relief depending on the circumstances. That relief may be back pay and damages, or it may be only prospective relief, like eligibility for promotions and training.
But I think the key takeaway in the case is if there is discrimination, then the federal government has acted unlawfully.
That's Roman Martinez, who argued Babb's case in the Supreme Court in January and faced a lot of skeptical questions, including this one from Chief Justice John Roberts.
So what type of discrimination, any type, let's say in the course of the, you know, weeks-long process, you know, one comment about age, you know, the hiring person who's younger says, you know, okay, boomer.
But in the end, Roberts and every other justice signed on to today's court opinion, except for Clarence Thomas, who dissented vigorously. Also today, the court ruled that police can stop a motorist driving a car that's owned by someone who's had his license revoked, even though the police don't know who the person behind the wheel is. In an 8-1 decision, the court said that unless there's reason to believe otherwise, it's common sense for a police officer to assume the car owner is driving and driving illegally. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
We've heard a lot about the critical shortage of protective gear for healthcare workers and about the urgent need for more ventilators to help keep patients with COVID-19 alive. Well, there is another shortage of grave concern. Hospitals are running out of the drugs those patients on ventilators require. NPR's Melissa Block has that story.
For a patient in acute respiratory distress, being put on a ventilator can be life-saving. It's also really unpleasant.
It is deeply uncomfortable.
Alex Morse is a pulmonary critical care physician at Sturdy Memorial Hospital in Attleboro, Massachusetts. She explains when patients are intubated, they're given strong sedatives and pain medicine and sometimes paralytic drugs. Without them?
Most people will kind of reach for the tube and try to grab it and pull it out. They may fight against having it in their mouth. And if they're working against a breathing machine, it can actually damage their lungs.
Now, with the surge of COVID-19 patients on ventilators, hospitals are burning through their supplies of those essential medications. Some have run out of certain drugs entirely. Others are down to just a few days' supply. They're even having to ration the use of albuterol, the common drug used to treat asthma. Doctors say they've been urging patients to bring in their albuterol inhalers from home. Dr. Morse has been watching her hospital's drug stocks dwindle and worrying about her patients.
It's the human cost of being scared, maybe being aware on the breathing machine when you really shouldn't be. That really keeps me up at night.
The drug shortages are especially acute in a COVID-19 hotspot like Albany, Georgia. That's where Shanti Akers works as a pulmonary critical care doctor at Phoebe Putney Memorial Hospital. They've seen their caseload of patients on ventilators soar from the typical 12 or 15 to as many as 46 at one time.
At present, we're running through anywhere up to 134 bags of fentanyl. Typically, pre-COVID, that would have lasted us 2 to 3 weeks. And now we're running through that quantity in simply a day.
Akers says the problem isn't just the overwhelming number of COVID-19 patients. They're also staying on ventilators much longer. Instead of a few days, it might be 2 weeks or more. And they require that much more medication.
The nightmare really is that I won't have enough ventilators to treat them all at the same time. And even if I get them on a ventilator, I won't be adequately able to sedate them to know that they're safe. And my real worry is that a lot of people will die as a result of that.
We have seen an increase in demand on pharmaceuticals that's unprecedented.
Dan Kistner manages the pharmacy program for Vizient, a group purchasing organization that negotiates lower prices with drug manufacturers. Vizient released data last week showing dramatic spikes in demand for the sedatives, pain meds, and paralytics crucial for patients who are on ventilators. But while demand is soaring, Kistner says, the supply chain is lagging far behind. Here's one complicating factor.
Injectable drugs take a long time to make. For instance, there's a 21-day sterility period needed for all injectable drugs, and so it's not something simple that you can do overnight.
Which means, he says, if you ramp up production of ventilators but don't also get a jump on producing the necessary drugs, you've got a big problem.
We're going to build all these cars, but if we don't have the gas, they can't go anywhere.
Adding to the problem, there aren't that many companies that make these drugs, says Aaron Fox, a pharmacist at University of Utah Health.
These hospital drugs are very, very cheap. It's just not a big profit-making arm for these companies.
Fox has tracked drug shortages for years. She says just as the Trump administration has put pressure on manufacturers to produce more ventilators, it's high time for them to exert the same pressure on drug makers and ask,
what are you doing to ramp up supply? What are you doing to make sure that we have enough medicines to treat all of the Americans who are sick?
Melissa Block, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Coming up in about 5 minutes on WBUR, the unveiling of a fund to help provide relief for those feeling the economic effect of the coronavirus in Massachusetts. That's still ahead. In the forecast, a few clouds moving in overnight tonight, down around 40. Tomorrow should be another nice day, sunny again in the low 60s. Wetter weather moves in for Wednesday with rain in the morning, clouds all day, highs only around 50. Up to 63 degrees now in Boston at 5:30.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Always Health Partners, a different kind of health plan with benefits and programs that put you first. Learn more at alwayshealthpartners.org or contact your broker. And Cambridge School of Culinary Arts, now offering on-demand online cooking and technique courses. Learn about their professional and recreational programs at cambridgeculinary.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. We'll have the latest news on COVID-19, but also the long history of presidents trying to comfort the nation during times of crisis. Historian Julian Zelizer will remind us words and actions count.
And we answer your questions about the coronavirus outbreak. That's next time on Here and Now.
Tomorrow at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. President Trump and Democratic presidential hopeful Joe Biden have spoken with each other about the nation's response to the coronavirus epidemic. The idea was first floated among their media advisors last week. No details yet on what was said. COVID-19-related deaths continue in New York, although there's some encouraging statistical evidence. But as NPR's Windsor Johnston tells us, the governor of New York is ramping up the assault on the potential spread of the virus.
Governor Cuomo says he's doubling the maximum fine for violating the state's social distancing guidelines to $1,000. In today's briefing, the governor said the daily count of new deaths has been effectively flat for 2 days, signaling that the curve of the virus in New York might be near its peak. Cuomo also says the daily rate of new hospital admissions has also dropped.
NPR's Windsor Johnston. This week's Wisconsin primaries are off. Wisconsin Public Radio's Laurel White has more on the governor's order rescheduling the vote.
Governor Tony Evers' executive order pushes in-person voting to June 9th. Mail-in ballots would continue to be collected in the meantime. More than a million people in Wisconsin have already requested a mail-in ballot for the election. Evers has been pushing without success for the Republican-controlled state legislature to approve delaying the election as cases of coronavirus continue to spread in the state. GOP lawmakers have pushed back, saying a delay would leave vacancies in hundreds of local offices across the state. Legislative leaders say they plan to issue an immediate appeal to the state Supreme Court, seeking a stay of the governor's order. They are directing clerks across the state to continue preparing for the election tomorrow. For NPR News, I'm Laurel White in Madison.
Boosted by a glimmer that coronavirus deaths might have stopped spiking, Wall Street closed significantly higher today. The S&P 500 up more than 7%, the Dow up 1627. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. The head of the Massachusetts General Hospital says the facility is preparing for a surge in coronavirus patients in the coming days. Hospital President Peter Slavin says MGH usually operates about 150 intensive care unit beds, but it can double its capacity to 300.
As of this morning, we had about 100 patients in the intensive care unit with COVID-19 or who were suspected of COVID-19. And we're just counting the days between now and the peak and hope that the capacity is sufficient.
Slavin says that capacity depends on the hospital getting enough ventilators and keeping medical staff healthy. A Framingham lab is now offering hospitals a rapid test to tell whether somebody has already had coronavirus. WBUR's Carrie Goldberg reports.
Boston Heart Diagnostics normally runs advanced blood tests related to heart disease, but as of today, it can also test for antibodies to the coronavirus. Those antibodies mean a person has had the virus and may now be immune. Lab President Pat Nolan says, as far as he knows, the test is the first COVID-19 antibody test available in New England.
We plan to partner with local hospitals to get this valuable information to the acute patients in hospitals, the hospital workers, and our first responders that we need to keep well so they can keep the rest of us safe.
He says Boston Heart Diagnostics can test 4,800 samples a day. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
Immigrant advocates in Boston are trying to prevent a government deportation flight bound for Haiti from taking off amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The Boston-based Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti says the flight is set to leave Louisiana tomorrow. WBUR's Shannon Dooling reports.
The Haitian government closed the country's international airports to commercial flights last month, but federal immigration officials are still planning on deporting Haitian nationals, many of whom have been in detention facilities up until now. Attorney Ira Alkali has a client from Boston who's scheduled to leave on a deportation flight to Haiti tomorrow.
I know that he has been in three different facilities in the last week and that there have been COVID-19 positives in all of those facilities.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, states online that detainees boarding ICE charter flights undergo temperature screening before boarding. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shannon Dooling.
The coronavirus outbreak is pushing back the start of a corruption trial for the former mayor of Fall River. Jaisal Correa's case was set to begin May 4th. It's now set to begin in mid-September. Correa faces charges of wire and tax fraud and extortion. A nice day, partly cloudy skies overnight tonight, down around 40 degrees. Tomorrow, mainly sunny and mild once again. Wednesday, showers, early gray all day. Right about 50 degrees, then for Thursday, clouds early, showers later, again around 50. 63 degrees now at 5:35.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack. For more than 40 years, Tire Rack has remained committed to helping people find the right tires, wheels, and performance parts based on driving needs and conditions. Learn more at TireRack.com. From ProQuest, whose ProQuest One Literature is a single destination for literary research, teaching, and learning, with a focus on diversity. ProQuest.com/go/NPR.
This is WBUR. I'm Lisa Mullins. Philanthropists are stepping up in Massachusetts to provide relief for those feeling the economic effects of the coronavirus pandemic. The governor, Charlie Baker, unveiled a statewide relief fund today. WBUR's senior statehouse reporter Steve Brown joins us with the details and the latest on the coronavirus figures from the Department of Public Health. Steve, why don't you start with those figures? Where do things stand?
Well, we're now up to 13,837 confirmed cases of coronavirus in Massachusetts. That's up 1,337 cases since yesterday. Over 76,000 tests have been administered, almost 4,500 more than yesterday.
I know last week you mentioned you were keeping an eye on the death rate and what that might indicate. What are you seeing now there?
Well, DPH says 29 people have died from COVID-19 in the last day. That's up from the 15 new deaths that were reported yesterday. That death rate has been fluctuating, up one day, down another. Of course, everyone's trying to get a handle on what those numbers mean. Governor Baker said you can't read too much into them.
I tend not to want to put too much into the dailies. I mean, it's important that we put them out there and people care a lot about them and they want to see them every day. But I think it's a mistake to draw big conclusions about whether or not a day number is a trend or even a 2-day is a trend.
Still, the governor is predicting that the surge of hospitalizations due to the coronavirus will be hitting sometime between April 10th and 17th.
One especially vulnerable population is those who are homeless. We are reporting on this today. Could you give us the numbers there?
Sure. According to the Boston Health Care for the Homeless, 200 people who are homeless in Boston have tested positive for the coronavirus. That's out of between 600 to 700 people who were tested. So it's a large share of the population. Most of the people who are homeless and have tested positive do not have symptoms, but they still can shed the virus. We're not aware of any deaths, but there are some homeless people hospitalized in intensive care and on ventilators.
Late this afternoon, Governor Baker and his wife Lauren announced the creation of a statewide COVID-19 relief fund. What did they have to say about it?
Well, already it has $13 million available to distribute, and they're hoping to raise more. Lauren Baker says it's to help those who will have the hardest time due to the economic impact.
We founded the Massachusetts COVID-19 Relief Fund to help people in every corner of this Commonwealth access the resources that they need. This fund is going to support essential frontline workers and other vulnerable communities who face issues like food and housing insecurity and the loss of critical services.
Now, Lauren Baker says the fund will partner with community foundations and local nonprofits throughout the state to get the resources to deploy the funds quickly and effectively.
We're seeing signs of increased stress on Boston hospitals. There's a curfew in Boston that takes effect in the city tonight. What is Mayor Walsh saying about this?
Well, he's asking that no one other than essential service providers be out in the city after 9 o'clock beginning tonight until 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. As you mentioned, we saw our first case of a hospital running out of room for patients. Boston Medical Center's ICU was at capacity last night. Fortunately, it is eased and again has a little more capacity today.
Over the weekend, Steve, Massachusetts took delivery of 100 ventilators from the federal stockpile. The state was counting on more than 10 times that figure. Now the state's congressional delegation is getting involved to figure out why so few were sent. What are they doing?
Well, with the surge of coronavirus illnesses expected to hit the hospitals later this week, the delegation sent a letter to FEMA saying Bay State hospitals will run out of ventilators within a week. Senators Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren drafted the letter with members of the House signing on. They say given the need, approving and sending only 100 ventilators to Massachusetts is grossly insufficient, and adds that FEMA can and must do more to help Massachusetts during this crisis. Now, yesterday, Governor Baker said he thinks there will be other deliveries of ventilators from the stockpile, saying he fully expects to get additional ventilators over the course of the next 2 weeks, but when and how many remains unclear.
Thank you. Once again, WBUR senior statehouse reporter Steve Brown.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In Europe tomorrow, finance ministers are meeting, virtually, of course, to try to bridge a divide. The divide is over how to pay for assistance desperately needed by countries hit hardest by the coronavirus. Tomorrow's talks are not likely to be a friendly discussion. Old divisions between the north and south of Europe are resurfacing. NPR's Silvia Pagioli is in Rome, and NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin. They're both here to talk about this. Hey, you two.
Hi there.
Hello.
Sylvie, I'm going to let you start. What has been the economic toll of the virus in Italy?
Well, Italy has this most stringent lockdown outside of China. Very few businesses and factories are working. We don't know how long it's going to last. And with a huge debt already, the Italian government approved a $28 billion emergency package. But it's much more is going to be needed to cover unemployment benefits for those who lose jobs, financial assistance for firms that stop production, and investments to relaunch the post-corona economy. And Spain is very close behind. In an op-ed for several European papers this weekend, Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said, Europe must build a wartime economy and promote European resistance, reconstruction, and recovery.
Rob, what about in Germany, the biggest economy in the EU?
Well, I think most of the EU thinks that the aid that Sylvia is talking about is a good idea, but the northern countries of the EU, especially Germany, the Netherlands, Austria, and Finland, otherwise known as the Frugal Four when it comes to these types of fiscal debates, do not think this aid is a good idea. The Dutch have been particularly vociferous about this. Prime Minister Mark Rutte said he could not foresee any circumstance when his country would support this type of assistance for other EU members.
Sylvia, I'm going to guess that resistance is not going down well in Spain and Italy?
Not at all. That attitude reopened the wounds of the euro crisis of a decade ago. When the outbreak started here, EU countries shut their borders with Italy. Dutch politicians blamed the outbreak on southern mismanagement, and Germany refused to sell medical supplies to Italy. It reversed itself only after Russia and China, with much fanfare, rushed medical aid to Italy. But so these old resentments resurface. Well, this time they can't do that blame game because all EU citizens are in the same pandemic boat together.
Rob, I mean, give us a little bit more insight into how the Frugal Four, as I've just learned, they are known, into how they see it. I mean, they also have bad memories of the Eurozone crisis a decade ago.
They do. And, you know, at that time, Germany was angry with Greece, Italy and Spain for not keeping their financial houses in order. And those old feelings are resurfacing. I spoke to Judy Dempsey, senior fellow at Carnegie Europe, about this. And here's what she said.
The Germans are highly reluctant to do this because they think this will just open the floodgates to long term lax fiscal discipline. The virus has exposed yet again old fundamental traditional cracks in the EU over how to deal with it financially.
Sylvia, speak to that. I'm curious your reaction. Are these fundamental cracks? Is European solidarity, the whole EU project, really under such strain?
They certainly feel that way here in the South. They see the German and Dutch proposals as punitive, too many austerity strings attached. Pro-European sentiment is already declining in the South, and the politicians here warned that halfway measures would only play into the hands of right-wing populists. Now, the Italians, like the Spanish, say the pandemic is a war requiring wartime tactics, a kind of Marshall Plan for Europe, not the old bureaucratic rules and regulations. They say northerners should see solidarity, even costly acts of solidarity, as acts of enlightened self-interest. If the economies of Italy and Spain collapse, they ask here, what will happen to export-based economies in the north? Or as the former EU Commission President Romano Prodi put it recently, if the southern economies implode, who's going to buy Dutch tulips?
So all of this would seem to bode really well for tomorrow's meeting when the EU finance ministers get together. Rob, what are we watching for?
Well, it's certainly going to be dramatic. German Chancellor Angela Merkel still prefers to use what's called the European Stability Mechanism to help Italy and Spain. And this was a loan program set up during the Eurozone crisis that in return for a loan forced states to implement strict austerity measures. But southern states would feel like they're being unnecessarily punished through a program like this. And secondly, there's only around $450 billion in this fund, and that's not likely enough to address the economic damage this virus has caused.
No, particularly when you compare it to the $2 trillion rescue package and more coming here in the U.S.
Right. It might fund one of the countries, but we're looking at many countries that need help here. And Merkel has actually come under a lot of criticism in her own country for her stance. Seven prominent German economists have called on her to change her mind. And the popular newspaper Der Spiegel ran an op-ed over the weekend calling Germany selfish, small-minded, and cowardly.
Wow. Before I let you both go, I wonder if I could get a quick snapshot from each of you just on how it's going where you are. Sylvia, you first. How is life today in Rome?
Well, let me give you a comparison. This is Easter week, and normally you would have tens of thousands of pilgrims and tourists, right all over the city. It is so quiet. I feel like I'm out in the countryside.
Yeah, this is Easter week, and those Germans would probably be in Italy or Spain right now. And so instead, they're here in Berlin at home, and people are outside. They're keeping their distance from each other. There's a lot of police patrolling the parks, but it seems to be functioning okay.
It's NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin and Sylvia Pagioli in Rome. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you're looking for ways that you can help out, these days there's plenty of need. Food pantries need non-perishable food, hospitals need masks, and lots of people, it turns out, need wheels.
Yeah, that is the idea behind a new program from the New York City-based advocacy group Transportation Alternatives.
The group's art director remembered he had an old bike with some life left in it.
He put it up on social media and immediately found somebody who needed it.
That's the group's executive director, Danny Harris.
And we realized that there are thousands of cyclists in New York who may have an extra bike that could be in the hands now of a frontline worker.
So they launched Bike Match.
You can think of it as a bike matchmaking service. If you have a bike, you put in some basic details and we'll work to connect you. So if it's a commuter bike versus a road bike, if you're tall or short, based on your neighborhood, we'll help to connect you to somebody who needs the bike.
The goal is to help the people who can't stay home during the pandemic get safely to work.
Delivery cyclists are feeding our city. Frontline workers are out, you know, doing everything from picking up the garbage to making our buses and trains run, and obviously our healthcare workers are on the front line of the crisis. A bike match is a very small way of taking an asset that you have and giving it to somebody who needs it.
Danny Harris says they have matched 42 people with bikes so far, and many more are in the works. Maria Salazar was matched with a black Specialized Cirrus.
She is part of the Astoria Mutual Aid Network. She's using the bike to deliver supplies like personal protective equipment and medication to people who can't leave home.
She says all this generosity is inspiring.
The fact that people just wanted to help no matter what, it just made me want to do more.
And Salazar says with car traffic way down, biking in New York City these days is actually quite nice.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Some people stuck at home because of the coronavirus are struggling with anxiety, stress, and depression. How to start or continue mental health care from home coming up. In the forecast, partly cloudy skies overnight tonight, down around 40. For tomorrow, a lot of light today, mainly sunny and mild. High temperatures again in the low 60s. 63 degrees now in Boston at 549.
On a reservation in Wyoming, some Native American families are crowded into two-bedroom houses.
Me and my husband, we have 8 children.
Putting them at extra risk of spreading COVID-19.
If one individual tests positive for it, of course it's going to be hard to quarantine just that one child and us as parents.
The challenges of a pandemic when housing is in short supply. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9, and when you ask your smart speaker to play WBUR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. For small businesses, federal help is on the way, or at least it's supposed to be. Friday was the first day small business owners could apply for the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP. It's a $349 billion pot of money designed to keep small businesses afloat until the economy reopens. But there are questions about whether that money will be enough and about how long it'll take to reach businesses that need it. Tina Rexing is the owner of T-Rex Cookie Kitchen in Eagan, Minnesota, and she applied for the loan last week. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about how the process of applying worked for you. Is it pretty straightforward?
It was kind of straightforward. My bank sent me a link to where I should apply. I entered in my average payroll for the last 6 months, and then I pressed apply. And then it just went into some sort of internet hole. And I haven't heard back in terms of, like, where it is in the process. Huh. I reached out to my banker this morning to see where it went, and they are still waiting to hear final instructions from the SBA.
SBA, that's the Small Business Administration. And so do you have any idea whether it's going to take days, weeks, months for you to see that money, assuming it comes through?
You know, I'm assuming it's going to take months. So as a small business owner, I'm really not counting on it. I'm just kind of doing what I can on my own to keep myself afloat.
Has the bank given you any guidance on timing, when they'll get back to you with an answer even?
No, I've been reaching out to my banker pretty much on a daily basis asking, you know, when is this coming through? If it's not going to come through or if I'm not going to be approved, because I don't think everyone is approved. I just want to be able to know that for sure so I can make certain decisions.
So tell us about how dire things are for you right now. I mean, what was business like before this pandemic hit and what's it like now? Are you able to do any sales at all?
Well, before it hit, I actually just opened a second location in a shopping mall. And so I was open for 2 weeks.
Wow.
And then I had to close. So the mall closed and had to let my staff, entire staff that I just hired, go. And I still have the kitchen where I do a lot of wholesale and retail. Some retail now I do curbside pickup. Mm-hmm. And I do a fair amount of online because I have an online partner that kind of helps me market to people outside of Minnesota.
So you've had to lay workers off, but what are your sales like now compared to what they were before?
It's probably half of what they were before. But at the same time, I don't have the expensive payroll. So I'm pretty much back to when I first started the company, doing everything myself. You know, it's just like starting all over again.
Now, this federal loan is potentially forgivable, but to get that, you have to bring back any workers that you've let go. Do you think business will pick up enough to make that feasible?
No, and that's what's kind of scary is that you bring these folks back, which I'd love to do because they were great, but then if there's not enough business to have them keep working, and then it's not 100% forgivable, or you don't know for sure if it is, I don't want to be stuck holding the bag to have to pay my employees if the money doesn't come through.
Yeah. So how satisfied are you with the federal response? Is there more that you would like to see?
I'd like to see a lot more, like, just to figure out when and give me some timing, because then I can tell my employees, yeah, I can bring you on with some certainty. But everything's so uncertain. And as a small business owner, you just don't want to make those decisions based on what you hear in the news. But everything's just in this limbo.
So at this point, how worried are you that your business might not survive the pandemic even with this federal assistance?
You know, I'm not worried that it won't survive. I'm just kind of concerned that it just won't be what it used to. And so I just have to make sure I pivot quickly and maybe even change the business model once this is all over. You know, I focused a lot on wholesale to event planning places and the U.S. Bank Stadium. And so that all dried up quickly. So I just have to figure out where else I could sell my product.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. Tina Rexing owns T-Rex Cookie Kitchen in Eagan, Minnesota. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
More than 4 out of 5 adults say the coronavirus pandemic has affected their mental health. That's based on a new poll by the Kaiser Family Foundation. But state stay-at-home orders mean people can't attend their regular therapy sessions in person. NPR's Lauren Hodges worked with NPR's Life Kit podcast to figure out the best way to start or continue therapy right in your home.
Therapy, or the goal of finally starting it, may be taking a back seat right now. People can't leave the house and have a lot on their plates. Telecommuting, homeschooling, unemployment. Mental health care seems out of reach if you've lost your insurance or your main source of income.
It's really difficult to feel so powerless, to feel so out of control.
Seth Gillihan is a clinical psychologist in Philadelphia who's moved all of his patient sessions online. He says it's become a necessary outlet as tension builds up at home.
People are on edge and cooped up and without their normal coping resources and access to friends and gyms and things like that. So it's definitely normal and common for nerves to get a little frayed and for people to be shorter with each other.
But how common is it to move sessions online? Crispin Roven is VP of Product at Psychology Today. He says the mental health community is adapting fast.
It looks like every therapist is starting to support online therapy in one way or another.
Therapists are stuck at home too, so they're willing to accommodate. And not just when it comes to location. With millions of people out of work and losing their health insurance, hourly rates are becoming more flexible.
There are therapists that specifically mention discounts or sliding scale applies during this time and are willing to adjust pricing according to financial need.
That's mostly up to each individual. So reach out and ask. Let them know your situation. Another place to search is Open Path Collective, a website with hundreds of professionals that offer rates between $30 and $60 per session. But if even that's out of reach, consider a free or low-cost support group. Psychology Today lists several groups by topic, and most of them have moved online or to conference calls. If your Wi-Fi's out or unstable, there are free 24-hour hotlines you can call. The Health and Human Services Department runs the National Helpline at 1-800-662-HELP. And if you're thinking of harming yourself, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is at 1-800-273-TALK.
We're seeing concern over family life, sleep, career. It's a real assault on people's stability.
Once you get back on track with therapy, Seth Gillihan says to try and work the topic of therapy into those FaceTime happy hours with friends and loved ones. They're probably struggling too.
We're only just realizing all the reasons why it's stressful and all the things that we've lost, realizing that, oh, okay, so pretty much everyone is going through something like what I'm going through, I think is really validating and may even help.
Because even though we're all apart right now, we're definitely not alone. Lauren Hodges, NPR News.
And our friends at LifeKit have a full episode on accessing therapy and other tips for getting through these times in their podcast feed. Just search for NPR LifeKit wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Elsevier, a global information and analytics business with more than 8,000 staff dedicated to combining content, data, and analytics to turn information into answers. Elsevier.com/careers. From Zoom, Zoom ties together communication tools into a single platform, including video conferencing, phone calls, and group chat. Zoom has more information online at zoom.com. Zoom, meet happy. And from T. Rowe Price, offering a strategic investing approach with a long-term perspective aimed at helping investors feel confident through a variety of market conditions. Since 1937, T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence.
After a beautiful day, we should have a few clouds moving in tonight, down around 40. Then for tomorrow, another nice one, sunny again in the low 60s. Wetter weather moves in for Wednesday with rain in the morning, clouds all day, highs only around 50. And for Thursday, more clouds, showers in the afternoon. Again, about 50, a little bit brighter though on Friday. 61 degrees in Boston at 1 before 6.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org.
And when you ask your smart speaker to play WBUR.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
The Prime Minister of Britain has been moved to intensive care in a London hospital. Boris Johnson was diagnosed with coronavirus 10 days ago. His symptoms got worse today. The 55-year-old is conscious and has deputized his foreign secretary. It's Monday, April 6th, and this is WBUR's All Things Considered. I'm Lisa Mullins. Also coming up, in 2009, then-Vice President Joe Biden was in charge of overseeing a massive stimulus package.
The vice president insisted that we put a real big emphasis on the Recovery Act in transparency and accountability.
Biden's handling of that stimulus provides clues as to how he might govern as president during an economic crisis. That story's still ahead. And there's been a steep climb in the spread of the coronavirus in Boston's homeless population this past week. The rate of infection is 7 times that of the general population in the state. These stories and more coming up. It's 6:01.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. As the death toll from the coronavirus pandemic continues to mount, New York City funeral homes and cemeteries are unable to keep up. NPR's Greg Allen reports officials say the city may have to temporarily inter some of the dead in a public park.
80 refrigerated trailers big enough to hold 100 bodies each have been deployed to hospitals throughout New York City. Some hospitals now have added a second and even a third trailer holding remains of people who died from COVID-19 or other causes. New York City Councilman Mark Levine says if the death toll doesn't soon level off, the city will likely start doing temporary interment, digging trenches in a city park where caskets will be buried.
Be done in a way that allowed these bodies in to be disinterred and given a proper burial at such time as the crisis is over and our normal cemetery system is and funeral home system is running again.
Levine says the Defense Department has sent mortuary specialists to New York City, but that more help is needed. Greg Allen, NPR News.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been moved into an intensive care unit today after symptoms of COVID-19 worsened. That's according to his Downing Street office, which says Johnson was admitted to St. Thomas's Hospital over the weekend. The British Prime Minister first announced he was suffering from the disease caused by the coronavirus 10 days ago and initially been continuing to run the country from his residence, but has now asked the Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab be deputized for him. Britain has no formal succession plan should the Prime Minister become incapacitated. The 55-year-old Johnson tested positive for the virus on March 26. South Carolina's governor is ordering residents of that state to stay home, with few exceptions. As NPR's Sarah McCammon explained, South Carolina had been among a dwindling number of states without stay-at-home orders.
Governors are under pressure from medical groups and federal officials, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, to order their residents to stay home in an effort to reduce the spread of the coronavirus. A handful of Republican governors have been holdouts, but now South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster says infections are rising and now is the time.
Too many people are on the roads, too many people are on the waters, too many people are in the stores, too many people are not requiring with our requests concerning social distancing.
Exceptions include work, outdoor exercise, or obtaining necessary goods and services. Violating South Carolina's stay-home order can be punished with fines or jail time. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
The interest rate-setting Federal Reserve is announcing plans to create a new program to finance loans that banks and other lenders make through the government's Emergency Small Business Lending Program. Banks began taking loan applications Friday. Those loans will come with a 1% interest rate and are aimed at keeping employees on the payroll for 8 weeks. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street today. The Dow was up more than 1,600 points. You're listening to NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. Good evening. I'm Lisa Mullins. Boston may have experienced a first in this coronavirus pandemic. The intensive care unit at Boston Medical Center was treating so many patients yesterday that the hospital had to turn away new patients in the ICU. WBUR's Carrie Goldberg has more.
The hospital says overnight Sunday, ambulances brought patients to other hospitals instead. But today, Boston Medical Center is back to accepting ICU patients. Boston health officials say this is the first known case of a Boston hospital reaching ICU capacity during the current COVID-19 crisis. According to the most recent numbers from the Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association, Boston Medical Center has 140 COVID-19 patients, with 39 in the ICU. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
The coronavirus pandemic is hitting Boston's homeless population hard. Dr. Jesse Gaeta of Boston Healthcare for the Homeless says there's been a steep climb in the number of new infections.
We're in about day three of a significant surge that is more dramatic than we anticipated.
Gaita says data tracking shows the rate of new cases among the homeless population in Boston is seven times what it is for the state's general population. Tighter budgets that have led to layoffs and furloughs because of the outbreak are now hitting many community health centers. East Boston Neighborhood Health Center says it's laying off 10% of its staff. It says it's been losing $1 million a week, with patient visits down 50%. Meanwhile, Massachusetts is launching a statewide coronavirus relief fund. Governor Charlie Baker says the fund will support many of the local foundations and community nonprofits that have been helping people throughout the state for years.
To help those who are going to have the hardest time working through and dealing with all of the economic consequence and public health consequence that's associated with this particular virus, make their way through.
Baker says the fund currently has $13 million in donations from organizations and businesses. In other news, some members of the state's all-Democratic congressional delegation are calling on Senate leadership to stop the federal government from seizing land from the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe in Massachusetts. In a letter, the lawmakers criticized the Department of Interior for deciding to take the lands out of trust, calling the move unprecedented. The tribe's legal challenge regarding is still playing out in the courts. It is 61 degrees now in the Boston area. Look for some clouds moving in overnight tonight. Not too many, down around 40 degrees. Tomorrow, lots of sun once again in the low 60s, cooler by the coast. And then for Wednesday, clouds roll back in and stay a while. It is again 61 degrees in Boston at 7 past 6.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of EdUtopia, an online resource dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students with information and strategies about what works in K-12 education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly, working today from my home studio.
And I'm Ari Shapiro at NPR headquarters in Washington. More than 10,000 people have died of COVID-19 in the United States. And as the pandemic spreads, hospitals around the country still don't have the protective gear they need to keep workers safe. That's according to a new watchdog report from the Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services. The report found that some hospitals have had to source N95 masks from auto repair shops or nail salons.
Well, let's hear now from someone who makes those masks. Michael Bowen is co-owner and executive vice president of Prestige Ameritech. That is the largest manufacturer of surgical face masks here in the U.S. He told me his company has dramatically ramped up production as factories elsewhere in the world idle.
I get maybe 300 to 400 emails a day. Most of those are asking for lots and lots of masks, you know, anywhere from 1,000, which is maybe a small hospital would ask for, to 50 million, 100 million. So I've been asked for billions and billions of masks over the last 60 or 80 days. It would not be an exaggeration.
How many can you make?
That's the problem. All the mask companies in the world can't meet the demand by any stretch. I mean, the demand cannot be met. Let me say it that way. The demand cannot be met.
This is a very basic question, but why can't you ramp up really quickly, really fast? This is a question of specialized equipment.
Yeah, and training. It takes a long time to build the machines, and this is a temporary situation. So for our company, ramping up past a certain point becomes a suicide mission. You know, we did this 10 years ago during H1N1, and we hired a lot of people and ramped up, and then we nearly went bankrupt afterward. We laid off 150 people and nearly went out of business. You know, it's not like flipping on a switch. It's building machines. It's hiring people. It's training people. That's the issue.
Stay with that experience from 2009 with H1N1. You ramped up. You were left with, what, a huge surplus of masks that you couldn't sell?
Well, what happened is we rose to the occasion. Hospitals were calling. We bought a bigger factory. We built machines. We hired an extra 150 people. And then when it ended, the people that we helped went back to the foreign-made masks. So we ended up having to lay off all of those people. And It was a very brutal situation.
I mean, I have read that since that experience, you have been sounding the alarm. I know you wrote to President Trump. I know you wrote to President Obama before him, warning that it wasn't going to be if, but when, that there would be another epidemic, right, and that the U.S. suppliers would come up short, that there had to be a better domestic supply chain, which is obviously not where we find ourselves. Are you being listened to now?
Well, I think so. I hope so. I think the difference now is, since this is so much worse, I'm hopeful that it will be different. But as we speak, the Department of Defense and the Veterans Administration even buy foreign-made masks.
What percentage of your orders come from the federal government? And I suppose I'm asking in part because we keep...
Zero.
It's all private customers, hospitals and so forth?
Yeah, it's hospitals and hospital distributors and dental distributors. We haven't done business with the federal government since 2010. Over the last 10 years, we have bid on the Department of Defense and the Veterans Administration's masks, and they always choose masks that are made in Mexico because they're cheaper.
I mean, make the case for me why the government and private business, why shouldn't they go with the cheapest option?
Because in a pandemic, the governments of every country is going to take care of their own people. If there's not going to be a pandemic, it's no big deal. But if you think there's going to be a pandemic, which experts do, and that borders are going to close and there's going to be infrastructure disruption, it's safer to have masks in the United States.
I have to note that for a man whose business is booming, you sound angry. You sound angry about opportunities were squandered.
No. I have been off and on. Of course, I've been telling this message for 14 years. But I'm really not angry. I'm puzzled. And I think what I've been fighting is not the government, not President Obama, not President Trump. I think it's human nature. I think since everybody ignored it, I mean, reporters ignored it, pandemic experts ignored it, our government ignored it, hospitals ignored it, everybody ignored it. So to me, it's a human nature problem. So I'm over my anger.
Yeah.
I just want to help everybody. I don't want to say I told you so. I just want to help everybody.
That is Mike Bowen. He's co-owner and executive vice president of Prestige Ameritech, the country's largest domestic manufacturer of face masks. Mike Bowen, thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Speaking of face masks, here's the current guidance. The CDC is recommending Americans wear cloth face coverings in public settings. Think grocery stores, pharmacies. Again, they should be cloth face coverings, not the N95 masks like the kind made by Prestige Ameritech. N95 masks are critical medical supplies. They should be reserved for healthcare workers and first responders. With or without a mask, the CDC says that 6 feet of social distancing is still the most important thing you can do to prevent the spread of the virus.
In 2009, like today, the country faced economic peril. Back then, Congress passed a stimulus package that cut taxes, expanded unemployment support, and more. The 2009 Recovery Act cost around $800 billion. And the person put in charge of overseeing how a lot of that money was spent was the country's new vice president, Joe Biden. Now, as Biden seeks the presidency, his handling of that crisis could shape whether voters think he's up to the job of handling this one. NPR's Asma Khalid has more.
On the day Barack Obama signed the Recovery Act in February 2009, he explicitly thanked Joe Biden for working behind the scenes to make the legislation possible. When Biden took the mic, he acknowledged the economy was in a downward spiral.
Last year, our economy lost 3 million jobs. 600,000 more just this last month.
And he promised a recovery.
We're here today to start to turn that around.
President Obama signed the bill, but then he swiftly handed all the supervision over to his vice president. Here's Obama describing Biden's new role.
As part of his duty, Joe will keep an eye on how precious tax dollars are being spent. To you, he's Mr. Vice President, but around the White House, we call him the sheriff.
Former aides say Biden took it personally if any stimulus dollars were wasted. Ron Klain was his chief of staff at the time.
We put a real big emphasis on the Recovery Act in transparency and accountability.
Estimates show around 1% of the roughly $800 billion was ever attributed to waste or fraud. Klain says being accountable also meant being efficient.
He held meetings with the cabinet as a whole, the various agencies that part of this, every other week to try to make sure we were moving quickly.
The vice president traveled the country to see stimulus projects in action, and every week he held phone calls with a rotating group of bipartisan governors and mayors.
The vice president insisted that the Recovery Implementation Office that reported to him, they had what he called the 24-hour rule, which is any question that a governor or a mayor raised got an answer within 24 hours.
Biden's real role was kind of opaque to people outside the White House. He occasionally gave press updates, but Jason Furman, who was the deputy director of the National Economic Council at the time, says that wasn't really what he did.
He wasn't even that much the public face of the Recovery Act. He was really almost behind the scenes, making sure it actually worked.
The impression from our end was that the vice president's role was something of a joke.
That last voice is Michael Steele, a former aide to John Boehner, who at the time was the Republican leader in the House.
Calling him Sheriff Joe and promising rigorous oversight of this program, it frankly symbolized that the president's priority, his attention, had shifted immediately to health care.
This was around the time that President Obama was starting to push for the Affordable Care Act. On the Recovery Act, Steele was peeved with the Obama administration as a whole. He says it did not court Republicans as much as it should have. Not a single Republican in the House signed on. Democrats insist they did try to court Republicans, and in fact won over a few in the Senate, thanks to Biden. But the lack of GOP support in the House had side effects. Douglas Holtz, a former economic advisor to John McCain's presidential campaign, says it made the Democrats more exposed to Republicans screaming about every dollar that didn't go right. And he says that affected how the Democrats implemented the stimulus.
So what do? They get more careful, which is at odds with recovery. You want to get the money out the door. It's an open question whether the vice president could have done something about that, but that's what he had to live with.
The question now is what this all means for the current moment. Jared Bernstein was Biden's chief economist during the Recovery Act.
He may be the most battle-tested president from the perspective of implementing stimulus plans than anyone I can think of.
Even Holtz Aiken, who thinks the 2009 stimulus was flawed, did not take issue directly with Biden. In fact, as critical as he was of the Recovery Act itself, he told me Biden's experience could be advantageous in our current times.
I think it's an asset. He can now, in his head, think, okay, we've got $350 billion at the SBA, and we've got $500 over at Treasury. They're going to have this list of problems. And he knows that.
The election in November may very well be decided by how President Trump handles the current crisis and its aftermath. As his likely Democratic opponent, Biden's campaign fully intends to put his record up as an alternative. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
On Sunday, New York City reported a rather unusual case of COVID-19.
A Malayan tiger at the Bronx Zoo has tested positive for the coronavirus.
According to the zoo, the 4-year-old tiger named Nadia appeared to be visibly sick with a dry cough by March 27th.
While only Nadia has been tested, 6 other big cats at the zoo are also showing symptoms.
So, yeah, animals can get the coronavirus. And it's not a jump to ask, what if our pets get it? Our pets!
Well, the USDA says there is no evidence yet that animals can spread the virus to people, and it is not recommending routine testing of animals.
But you should wash your hands after petting your dogs, your cats, ferrets, hamsters, and so on.
And as for whether we can give the coronavirus to our pets?
The American Veterinary Medical Association and the CDC have recommended you can never be too careful.
So if you suspect you might have COVID-19, it is best to limit contact with your furry friends.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. On Wall Street, the week starts with big gains. The Dow grew by 7.73%. That's 1,627 points. It closed at 22,680. S&P and NASDAQ rose more than 7% each. The S&P finished the day at 2,664, and the NASDAQ ended at 7,913. Marketplace has details in about 10 minutes. It's 19 past 6.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by BayPath University Graduate School's MS in Nonprofit Management and Philanthropy. Enrolling now for June 29th. Apply at baypath.edu/graduate.
Let's get the forecast now with meteorologist Dave Epstein.
Sunshine the rest of the evening. Temperatures in the 50s. Late at night will fall towards 40. Mostly sunny for Tuesday. Low 60s generally, but It will be a little cooler at the coast, especially Cape and the Islands, in the 50s. Wednesday, rain in the morning, clouds in the afternoon, temperature near 50. Thursday, it's cloudy to start the day, rain to finish, temperature near 50. As we head for Friday, partly sunny, also near 50.
Go to WBUR.org/coronavirus for the latest news, to find answers to your questions, and also to sign up for our email alerts. That's at WBUR.org/coronavirus. 61 degrees now. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFA Institute. CFA charterholders are wealth managers committed to helping unlock opportunities for their clients' ambitious wealth goals. Learn more at therightquestion.org. From Rock Auto, an online auto parts store, shipping parts directly to customers worldwide. Everything from complex sensors to new carpet. More at rockauto.com. And from the ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
This is WBUR's All Things Considered. I'm Lisa Mullins. Boston's homeless community is experiencing a significant increase in coronavirus cases. About 200 people who are homeless have tested positive for the virus, according to Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program. 600 to 700 have been tested at tents set up outside the biggest shelters in the city. There are no known deaths from COVID-19 among people who are homeless in Boston, but some are hospitalized in intensive care on ventilators. There is a growing sense of urgency among clinicians and homeless service providers. Dr. Jesse Gaeta, the chief medical officer for Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, says there's also increased anxiety among people who are homeless because of the virus and because of having to move to different facilities for quarantine and isolation. Dr. Gaeta says it's already been a difficult week.
We're in about day three of a significant surge that is more dramatic than we anticipated. We've got many new cases per day now that we're discovering, and we're working desperately to take those folks out of congregate settings into places where they can be isolated.
And is there some commonality among the people who are testing positive right now? Are they in a particular area? Do they have a roof over their heads right now?
We have, together with help from the city and others, we have stood up now a handful of isolation facilities, including two tents here in the South End, including what was the old Kindred Hospital on Commonwealth Avenue, where we've got space for about 70 people. And now, because the need is outpacing our ability to put people in those facilities, we're working really hard right now to scale up much bigger isolation facilities. So those things are evolving rapidly. We're going to need those beds now. The kind of overall strategy right now is test as many people as we can in congregate settings and pull out everyone who tests positive into isolation.
And how many of those people have been brought to the hospital?
We're actually trying only to bring to the hospital the people who are moderately to severely ill. What I can tell you is that most of the people testing positive right now don't have symptoms, which is exactly what we've come to expect from what we've learned about this virus, is that it can be transmitted before people have symptoms.
And are you able to get sufficient testing kits and get a fast turnaround on the results?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's improved quite a bit. So the turnaround on the test results right now, as we've been mostly using the state lab, has been much quicker. It's down to about 24 hours. You know, the testing resources, though, are kind of seem to be waxing and waning a little. So whereas we were able to test over the course of last Thursday and Friday, we were able to test about 400 people in 2 days. Today, we don't have enough testing kits to keep going at that clip, and the state is trying hard to help with that resource.
Can you give us a picture? Is there kind of a line of people right now waiting to be tested, and are you able to have them maintain the proper distance from each other? I mean, what's it like there?
Yeah, it's really hard. So, you know, when people are coming into the front door of a shelter, There can be bunches of people, and we try really hard to ask people to keep distance, and it's hard for everyone. I was just thinking about the fact that we tested about 400 people last Thursday and Friday in shelter, and to do that, we set up 3 testing tents, and we got really efficient with the paperwork and the procedure itself. And it was raining on Thursday and Friday. Like, it was actually terrible outside. And so these folks were lined up. In some cases, it was, you know, many people lined up and trying to space out. So the line looked like it was a couple blocks long.
This is a difficult population because many of these people have underlying health conditions. But could you tell us, is there a profile you can give us of the kind of people you're seeing who are testing positive? Or is it hitting the general population pretty much across the board?
It's hitting the general population across the board. I guess what I would say is what's unique about this population is just by virtue of not having a home, they're likely to be living in congregate, very crowded settings. And so they're at higher risk of transmission just by virtue of that fact. So we're seeing right now that the rate of new cases among homeless people per 1,000 people is about 7 times what it is across the state of Massachusetts. And so we're on a steeper incline right now for homeless people in Boston than we are generally, and that makes sense. We're changing the way that we work dramatically right now because we have large populations of people who are positive and have a lot of risk of deterioration, you know, and we're working with fewer staff than we'd like, and we're doing the best we can. It feels like disaster medicine.
And when you say working with fewer staff, is that because you're generally understaffed anyway or for this particular circumstance?
No, we're generally so well-staffed, but we've pretty much have had to really pivot on a dime from our usual activities of providing primary care in shelters and in clinics set up specifically for this population. We've had to nearly abandon all of that work, a lot of it, and pivot to this public health work, which is identifying people who are positive and scooping them out of the general population as soon as we can. We're stretched thin. You know, many of us on staff here at Healthcare for the Homeless, you know, attend on the inpatient wards at MGH or BMC, and they're pulling their staff in to handle the crisis of severely ill patients in the hospital. And we're staying where we are in the community, but fewer and fewer nurses and doctors are able to provide community care because the hospitals need so many people.
Let me ask you that about that, though. Do you feel like you're being shortchanged?
No, I don't feel like we're shortchanged. I think we need our healthcare resources where the people are the sickest. Like, you've got to triage us the way we would triage or prioritize anything else. I think we're definitely going to need help, and we're going to need more people.
So you're kind of putting out the call right now, recruiting people.
I'm definitely putting out the call for action. This is what we've trained our whole lives for. This is our moonshot. We've got to do the best we can to flatten what is right now a very steep upward curve among homeless people in Boston. We can't do it alone. I do think we need our intensivists and hospitalists working in the hospital, people that do community medicine. If you're not busy right now, we need you.
We wish you luck. Dr. Jesse Gaeta, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Jesse Gaeta is Chief Medical Officer of Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years. GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO.
Sunshine for a little while longer. A few clouds moving in overnight tonight, down around 40. Tomorrow should be a lot like today. Lots of sunshine in the low 60s, cooler by the coast, though. Wednesday, clouds roll back in and stay a while. Should be rainy Wednesday morning, dry later on, topping out at about 50. Then for Thursday, rain should hold off until the afternoon, right around 50. Friday should bring back some sunshine. 61 degrees now in Boston at 6:30. Marketplace is coming up next.
On a reservation in Wyoming, some Native American families are crowded into two-bedroom houses.
Me and my husband, we have 8 children.
Putting them at extra risk of spreading COVID-19.
If one individual tests positive for it, of course it's going to be hard to quarantine just that one child and us as parents.
The challenges of a pandemic when housing is in short supply. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9 WBUR.